Hello and welcome back, dear listeners, to the second episode of Reject and Resubmit. Back with you on the ones and twos. Today are
Philip
and Marco.
And myself, Alexander, this time broadcasting from Poland, this time with a dog that will definitely not get any ideas to bark loudly during our recording. And to honor our tradition in this podcast, I want to start off this episode with a question as old as time itself. So, what are the favorite brands of Germans according to a 2024 poll? And I will say this much. If you guess the first place correctly, I will, live on air, say that analyzing interviews counts as scientific research.
Oh, there's quite a lot to gain.
Mercedes-Benz.
Mercedes-Benz, okay. I swear, you will... You'll blow my mind if you guess this one correctly.
What does
you all know the brand.
What does it mean, favorite?
It's according, of course, that question would come. It's a...
patriotic in a good way. However, I go for Apple, actually.
Wow, you both, none of your brands are even in the top 10.
What?
Yeah.
So what is in the top 10? Kaufland?
Edeka.
No, but it's, I'll give you this much. Aldi is in the top 10, but it's
yeah, Aldi,
ninth.
Banger. Miss it, dearly.
Ninth. Aldi place nine. Place nine. I'll tell you one that I'm sure you wouldn't have thought about being in the top 10. On place three is Samsung.
Yeah.
Ah, so.
My washing machine is from Samsung.
But how come Samsung is in the top 10 and not Apple?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't get it. Should I tell you the second place, or do you want to give it another guess now that I've given you a few?
Kentucky Fried Chicken.
No.
You, as Germans, what are your favorite brands?
Apple. No, I don't know.
Bosch. Place five.
Like Bosch.
Bosch. What the fuck are you, like a 45-year-old dad of four?
of four what?
Bosch washing machines.
Bosch.
Yes. Good, nice.
Lufthansa
is good.
I'm pretty sure they make the list of most hated brands, but
next to Deutsche Bahn, you mean? Yeah.
But I'll give it to you. I swear to God, I'm sure you wouldn't have. We could have done this for another 10 minutes. It's PayPal.
PayPal. My favorite brand. Ganz ehrlich,
favorite brand.
I don't believe you. The question was brands you know.
Pronounce it even wrong, right? It's not PayPal, but PayPal. And
maybe it just sounds nice when you say
PayPal.
It in German. PayPal.
That doesn't PayPal. Sound German. That sounds
Philip
Austrian.
Doesn't even have PayPal, so I'm not sure.
I was once scammed. PayPal. So
by Elon Musk himself.
Yes.
Next time, let's have a discussion who is funding YouGov and whether this is the best use of their resources.
Who's YouGov?
Yeah, it's coming. Hot next topic. YouGov and Handelsblatt were the two that did the representative survey. Lego is also on there. I'll post the link somewhere in our show notes.
Playmobil.
Amazon. Okay, I'll go back just because of the people. This is what they tune in for.
Yeah.
Amazon, Aldi, Adidas, yeah. Nivea, DHL, Bosch, Lego.
DHL.
I love DHL.
This is so random. Yeah, because everything else is just so terrible that you're gonna. It's like, I don't know. There's a name for that cycle. It's Stockholm syndrome or something. Samsung is three. DM is two.
DM is great.
DM is pretty awesome.
I miss that dearly. Yeah.
Yeah, and PayPal.
Nice.
All right. With that out of the way, great episode, guys. And
thank you so much. See you in 4 weeks.
Sorry. No, now let's get into the actual meat of this juicy episode. Who do we want to start with? Do we want to start with topic on research, topic on work, or the topic on life itself?
I choose research.
All right.
Is it me?
I think that's you.
What
yeah.
a coincidence.
So, what, who would have thought? Let's go with the most important first.
Can I speak now, please? So talking about fun endeavors, like lists, I want to talk with you about the notion of doing research based on data and context that we are personally deeply interested in. So the example of, for example, looking at the development of synthesizer technology as an example of how innovation works, or looking at cycling teams in order to understand how teams collaborate, or pretty much everything that Alex ever does.
I feel personally attacked.
I was meant like that. So these kind of data sets. I haven't done that yet. And to be honest, I'm also a bit careful. But because I know Alex did that, can you maybe share how that feels for you? Is that something that you always want to do and you now feel that you reached that point? Or is it something that you sold your soul and now you don't even enjoy your own hobby anymore?
I mean, my academic paper graveyard is filled with ideas and half-started projects that I thought about with data that's fun or data that's related to fun things. The thing is, like so many things, you know, the idea itself tends to be fun, but then when you get into it, like at some point, even fun data turns into really annoying shit data, with all the kinds of problems that make, you know, research just the fun that it is. We're still, like, I just had a meeting today with my co-author working on the music data project. And it's a pain. It's like, it's getting the data and working with the data is just a lot of work. But the thing is, it's if it works out, I think it's amazing. I think it's those things where you can really, you know, it's, I don't know if I'd be, you know, looking back on a, or that's just on me, but looking back on a paper of organizational practices of pharma companies. And if I had like access to company data there to study, I don't know, some processes, I mean, it'd be a cool paper for sure, but I don't think that's something that I'd be really excited about to talk about. Whereas all these other projects, you know, those are subjects you can at least, you know, also talk about outside, even easier to talk about outside of academic colleagues. So that's the upside. Really. We're doing, by the way, great listeners, for the time, by the time this will be out, it'll be over, but we're doing a PDW at AOM on exactly that, on using the entertainment industry as organizational research context. So we'll see. There's gaming. I've got I'm in chats with people to look at prices of Magic the Gathering cards. I wanted to do something on porn and it got scooped, talking about things I enjoy doing.
I enjoy dearly. I'm an expert in.
I love talking. I love, you know, it's most of my free time, which I'll be talking about later. And the music stuff, I got a colleague that's looking at movie stuff and he'll probably, I feel like he's got a similar experience. It's, you know, it's some a topic of great interest that you feel passionate about. But once you get into the data and you realize, you know, at some point, just the challenges for any kind of data turn out to be very similar. Mm. But then with that on top of it, the issue with this kind of fun, you know, funny data in our field, in management and business and marketing, in anything in econ, is like, it's, I remember I pitched this idea I had for Magic the Gathering pricing data to my current boss here. And he told me, yeah, I mean, that's like an amazing idea for the International Journal of Magic the Gathering.
Currently ranked B, right?
Yes, I know. It's too ambitious for me, so I didn't decide to pursue that. I thought I can't, you know. But that's the thing, is like, as soon as you have to start talking about, yeah, well, but how does this inform, I don't know, management, human resources, marketing, something wider than the context of interest, or how is this relevant to a group of people beyond the ones that are, you know, deeply in this subject matter? That's also then, it's a bit of an art, really. I think like there's a few authors that manage to really, you know, take these kinds of contexts and this kind of data and really clearly see how to frame it and spin it. But I'm certainly not one of them. So that's always has been and probably always will be quite a big challenge, using that data is kind of, you know, figuring out how this is informative to people beyond aficionados.
Will we see your Strava data recycled as a paper, Marco?
I would love to. However, I guess I'd start off with a rather unpopular take, but like every time I see one of these papers being published, I feel like it's more about the name rather than the data. So you usually see
the title of the
sport. Yeah, I mean, you could say that I guess about pretty much every data set, but like, if I see one of, like, from in my case in OB, for instance, if I see people publishing the sports data, they usually are, I don't know, work at Harvard Business School, Stanford, and so on and so forth. And I basically never saw a paper published with that kind of data from regular academics, quote unquote.
Mm.
Is this kind of a misconception, or is this confined to my field, or... I don't know, Alex, please enlighten me so I can recycle my Strava data.
It's okay to recycle the Strava data. Boy, you might have a point. You know, I mean, I
think the two perspectives that you had are actually deeply linked, right? If you work with the data because you find the data interesting, I think you have a problem. But if you're extremely well-versed in the theoretical literature, in the questions that are open, and then you can make a case that there's this question out there that is super interesting, and we cannot tackle it really with organizational data, but we can look at it from a sports data perspective, then you have something, right? But it's very hard to go the other way around. You cannot say, I have sports data. What kind of question can I answer with that? I think that is challenging. And that is why we see, I think, top names on these kinds of papers, because those are the folks that can spin a story that informs a conversation that is open or ongoing or unresolved for like 10, 20 years. And now they can bring in a new perspective with an interesting data set. And these papers are always framed the same. They're always like, yeah, there's this huge question, and we can never tackle it, but we use this super interesting data set that has not been looked at, and it's sports data. Guys, got you. But now you already read two pages, and I will walk you now through the sports data. And I think this is how it needs to be done, right? You cannot really set up the hook with no one looked at magic cards before. That's that's tough. But saying, like, I don't know, Magic the Gathering has a super unique market level criteria that is actually unique for how magic cards are traded. I think that's an econ question. I have no idea about markets. And then you can use magic cards as an example for that, and then theorize back to markets. I think then you have an interesting case.
I think there's certain fields where this works easier than others. I don't know nothing about OB, but I think there the link is very, very, I mean, I imagine the link has to be very, very clear to organizations and organizational literature. Whereas, you know, fields, let's say economics or marketing, just in general, like if there's, or let's just take economics, if you can make some kind of claim on like what Philip said around markets in general, or if you can make some kind of welfare implication, then it's in that sense it's easier to use. It's easier to use different contexts. It's harder in other ways, of course, but There, I have a feeling it's where in management and organizational research, the challenge is what Philip said. And in econ, I think it's like probably, you know, how can we, you know, how do we learn about some new market mechanism? It doesn't really matter. They didn't look at a context and then think, what a stupid context, what's the relevance? It's more of like, you know, okay, so how does this build on this 1984 paper that should have already explained everything situation? I agree. Yeah. But it's, I mean, and the problem is, I'm fully in the latter camp that Philip mentioned. I always see cool data and look at cool data and then only think about, wait a second, how am I going to make this relevant for the actual audience of academic papers and in management and IS, which is difficult.
What would be a dream data set? That do you have a data set that you think could be super interesting to work with, but you're kind of afraid to touch it?
Yeah, the magic card data. I mean, it's like I've got daily granular pricing data of.
I wonder where
for
we
the
have
last
that
four
as well.
Years.
Daily data for a market that changes every day.
For the entire,
for different asset classes, maybe different risk portfolios.
Yeah,
maybe.
No, I honestly don't know what you're talking about.
Cannot relate.
I wonder as well, honestly. Like, I'm just as baffled as you. So, yeah. I don't know. I wish anybody could answer that question. Yeah. But yeah, it's like, that's something, it's massive as well. It's a massive data set. Like, it's not something I could just open and look into, but it'll take an immense amount of work. So that's why I haven't really touched it yet. But yeah, that's there. I have that data and I just haven't touched it yet because a lot of people have been, with good reason, warning me about, you know, wasting my time. Basically,
international journaling for magic card is in decline.
No, no, it's just got really, really, really a high rejection rate. So it's just really risky.
Yeah.
I should just study AI or something. That's pretty much that should be done.
Marco, do you have a data set that you would like to look into?
Honestly, no. But over the last couple of weeks, I really got into this, not the data set itself, because it's hard to get, but data about cyclists, as you teased earlier. Because now more and more cycling teams are starting to hand out these tenured positions in a way. Which is weird, right? I never heard that.
Because it just works so well in academia.
I guess similar to the tenure criteria within universities, I feel like it would be interesting to see how these tenured positions affect their results in a way. And their results are super tangible,
I'm intrigued,
right?
To be honest.
So, however, the sample size so far is, I think, 4.
People that
were tenured yet, but obviously, like every year they have this, or every second year, elite cyclists have this contract year. So just like the year before you are, or the year that you are on the market. So I think it would be interesting to see whether there is actually a difference in performance in a way. And as it's a very physical sport, yeah, I don't know. I feel like it's an interesting question to look at. But also, as cyclists not only work, it's not all about the physics, but also about your team and team collaboration. So also how, collaborative in a way your fellow teammates are. So if you are, next to, like, head to head, is the person sprinting or is he not sprinting and stuff like that? So I think there would be quite a lot of questions that you could answer with this data, but
very different again, strategies by the cycling teams and so on and so forth, right? So,
strategies,
I'm sure there'll be a Nature subjournal out soon for
cycling.
For cycling. Nature cycling.
Nature cycling. International Journal of Cycling Studies.
For cycling studies. It's a sister journal of the Magic the Gathering.
It's maybe both published by Frontiers or something. Frontiers and Magic the Gathering.
Frontiers and Magic the Gathering and cycling.
And cycling.
It's like both. It's
Philip, where would you publish your Frontiers in the data?
What I find super interesting is chess data. I know it's also
boring.
I know.
Basic.
But it is quite interesting because it's so isolated and you have AI affecting this. People learn different moves. You can see whether people who play or use the technology of AI to improve their techniques, how they improve it, how they change their game. I think that's quite interesting. But I know that also quite many people work on this, so it's also not super duper novel. And as I said, I don't have a question that I want to answer with it. But I think I love like compact data, and chess data is super compact, so you only need like very few rows to describe the entire game. So you can look at enormous numbers of games played in very quick time succession, and that I always find very intriguing when you can get access to the entire universe.
Chess universe.
Yeah, you say it with a certain notion that I don't get.
The entire universe seemed
more chess position than particles in the universe. So I think it's not small.
Okay.
But not more than there are magic cards in the universe. So
that yes, that I don't know.
You will find the answer in the Frontiers in Numbers journal.
It's random.
Frontiers in Numbers go up. Yeah. Edition 904. Nice.
Right.
Okay. That leads us almost very nicely to the topic of free time already, isn't it?
That's a good point. Oh, cool. My iCloud wants to update.
Yeah, keep us updated about that. Intriguing.
love the pop-up now. Yes, so basically, which is what I want to get into, and which might, you know, be in line, is basically are we as academic researchers allowed to or supposed to switch off at some point? And why I'm asking that question, and I think this is something that we might have talked about in a previous older episode, is that I read somewhere on LinkedIn, you know, under the numerous complaints about the working conditions in our field, someone had the really insightful comment that this is a labor of passion, and basically, you know, if you can't handle the heat, then get the fuck out of the kitchen situation. So yeah, what do you think? Is it allowed? Are we allowed to do anything apart from thinking about research and how we can use
what
everything we see and touch for research?
What would switching off constitute? So what would it mean to switch off for you?
To take weekends off and not work. Like put it this way, are we allowed to treat our job like a 9-to-5? And maybe let's mean 9-to-5 in the sense of not necessarily exactly that way, but are we allowed to have a, you know, work during the week, take time off in the evenings and on the weekends? Or is this just a job where we can, you know, maybe have a weekend every few weeks, and if we're lucky, you know, take an evening.
I will lose my hireability in the US in 30 seconds and tell you that I always take the weekends off and also take the evenings off. So if we define working as sitting in front of a computer and typing down something or coding or writing or whatever, I do that during office hours.
Okay, Marco?
Yeah,
I'm sure
obviously
you can
exactly also
the same.
Conceive our job slightly broader. So I don't know. Getting these student emails, or I was asked to download this Canvas, and now they have a teacher app, so I have the Canvas teacher app. So if people mm-hmm. write me a message, it goes straight to my Canvas teacher app, which obviously
sounds wonderful.
What the fuck?
Which obviously there are no notifications.
Obviously,
so.
Also obviously you have this job.
Yeah. So I guess.
I think he froze.
I think his canvas. He just got 500 canvas.
He got canvas. he got a message from his student.
He just got canvas.
So this means you in the evening sit down and still work until like 9 or 11 or what? And then you get up at 9 and continue working.
No, I just feel terrible for.
Yeah, sorry, Marco, you were gone. You were gone after I burst out in tears and said, obviously, it's your job. And then you were gone, so you need to repeat the last few sentences.
I had the perfect phrases, but now I go to the rather dull version of it. But no, to go back to the... Basically, there's this idea of passion exploitation in entrepreneurship, but also in HR more and more. And I feel like this is something that universities profit from. And I think the structures are already also kind of tailored in a way that you are more or less prone to exploit your own passion for research. Because nobody's going to tell you, hey, I saw you published quite a lot recently. You might want to stop. At least I haven't heard that before.
I haven't heard that. No.
Calm down, man.
Calm down. Yeah.
You're becoming too smart and interesting.
Google Scholar is basically heating up.
It's full now.
The rankings of our university only go so high.
We cannot accept more students, and there are too many applications. Please stop. But no. I feel like the incentive structure really, fosters passion exploitation or exploiting one's own passion in a way. Having said that, I'm very good at exploiting my own passion. So
you don't say.
And while I think it is not worthwhile not to switch off in a way, because I guess all of us have been in this spot where you try to solve a riddle, have a bug in the code or whatever, and then you stop working because, I don't know, you're kicked out of your office, or I guess there's a plethora of reasons. However, next day you open up R or Python or whatever and you see it right from the beginning. And I feel like this downtime is super crucial for being productive. And Philip and I had an extensive talk about it the other, like, I guess a couple of years or weeks ago, or every time actually we meet.
Years or weeks ago.
Days. No, I think it's something we talked about.
It's a recurrent theme.
It's a recurrent theme, okay. Yeah. But I think we should make it more acceptable if people switch off. And B, I think we also should force ourselves to switch off in a way to also, I don't know, let the creative energies flow again, which sounds like something I would have found in interviews, but I guess there's also some OB literature to back it up.
I find it just like, it's a tricky topic, right? Because I mean, there just are people whose life is research, right? Like they that's their hobby. You know, that's what they enjoy doing. Like for them, this is switching off, like being able to work on their research or being able to, I don't know, design courses, whatever. So it's like, but at the same time, it kind of makes the rest of us, quote unquote, look bad. If, you know, this one person that's just really productive and outshining everybody else with their publications, or is just putting extreme amounts of effort into their teaching or whatever, just because they love it. And so it's like tricky because it's kind of a decision I feel like you nearly can't even make on your own, right? Without taking on, unless you're prepared to like make the sacrifice in a way.
But I think this is kind of a wrong conception, because it comes from the assumption that you always have to compare yourself against others, right? And I feel like there are a lot of matrices that make it super tangible. However, you don't need to look at all these matrices. And I don't know, I have colleagues who have, I guess, way less citations, but a lot of great AMJ publications. But as it's hard to actually read the AMJ article at times, they're not cited that well. So like these matrices are super skewed. And if you put in, sometimes I also notice, like, if I put in 10 more extra hours in my teaching, it doesn't make 20% or that doesn't shift the needle in a way. So okay. I feel like, we need to, not stop comparing, but do it in a, realistic fashion. Also considering different starting points, for instance, or different, strengths. Because if we as European scholars compare us to US scholars, we will always fail if it's not about teaching, right? So in this regard, I'm talking more to myself than to you guys right now, but I really think that this is something you might or one needs to learn in a way, because there will always be a bigger fish in this rather small pond.
I want to add that I just said that I work during office hours, but that doesn't mean that research is not my life. I would very strongly say that research is my passion and my life and my core thing I do. I also run or make music or whatever it is, but this is just a way of recharging to then do research yet again in a very focused manner. And I'm working on a project that is 6 years old, and I reframed it again, and I have the stamina to do so, but only because I don't do that 68 hours a week. I do it 15 hours a week. And this allows me to collect the data yet again, to extend the data set, to reframe it, to read more, to think about it again, to write it down, to get rejections, and so on and so forth. So for me personally, I can only make research my life by not having it extend over, let's say, 45 hours a week. I cannot do that. And I believe that very few people can actually do that. And I think the research itself suffers because it becomes more narrow and more niche and more specialized. Mm. But I don't want to be a scholar that's like super in depth in like one super duper tiny thing. I want to be broader. I want to have interesting thoughts and interesting conversations beyond the niche that I'm in. I want to have these conversations to then bring interesting thoughts into the niche I am in. And for that, I need time. And I need the time to listen to podcasts, to read books, to go cycling with Marco and have interesting conversations. And if this is not there, then I cannot do my work well. And this is how I see it.
Okay.
And maybe one more observation. Okay. I mean, ideally, you can do this until the end of your lifespan, right? In practice, this is not the case. And at one point, you will be retired, or you are, some people say, even forced
you
to
will
retire.
Be retired.
Yeah, because I feel like, I talked to a couple of professors that are in this, like, just you're approaching this career stage, and they're not super happy about it. And it then can be rather frustrating if you are if you notice that within your community you don't know anyone. I mean, within your like rural community, and this is basically something a professor shared with me the other day, that now he needs to start to build a new network because his entire network is attached to research. And I feel like this is also kind of a sad story you hear every now and then with consultants spending their entire time in consulting, working with the same people all over again. And they are kind of forced to stick in the job because their social network is attached to it. And I feel like we should also be careful about our social network. Also, to make research more relevant, I guess, as you said, Philip, because if we are spending all of our time working in research, discussing with other researchers, I guess we also lose touch with the real world, quote unquote.
Yeah. Good points.
So you're allowed to play magic once in a while, Alex?
Oh, thank God. Just need to find a social network.
Friend.
Just need to find a friend.
But you can
it's getting, it's getting rather, online, rather boring playing against myself.
Against the mirror.
against my dog. No, okay. Yeah, I mean, good points. I feel like the pressures are still there. I mean, the one thing it's like, it's reaching a point where I feel like in certain positions, it's nearly being treated as if research has to be your free time activity. there's like some PhDs or something, you know, like, hey, you should be happy if you can do research, and like your job, your 40 hours you're getting paid for is the other stuff. And that seems to be, at least in my, as competition ramps up, something that's also getting kind of shipped around. You know, you need to do your editorial work, you need to do your teaching, you need to do what have you. And then if you have any hour left in the week or in the weekend, then yeah, sure, you can work on your research. Because it should be your, like, this should be something you enjoy doing. So if it's something you enjoy doing, you should be willing to do it in your free time. Which is, you know, that's a bit of a development that's concerning as well. But yeah, I don't want to over belabor this.
Just one point quickly to add. For me, what at least allows me to largely remain in the office hours is that research is always top priority, right? Everything else I do is very heavily weighted against, can I rather do research? So yeah, during my PhD I already taught a lot, so I think I can do the teaching in an efficient manner without overloading me too much. And yeah, and every other thing that you can do at university is weighted against a few hours more of research. And I think, yeah, maybe that's a trade-off that needs to be done.
Okay. Then let's move on to the.
That was a lot of fun. A very fun topic of life.
It's really fun. Can't wait to totally take a break after this podcast and not do any more work.
And remember, instead of this podcast, you could have done a bit of more research, right?
This counts as work, honestly.
This counts as free time. It's after six.
No, it's not magic. Anything that's not magic is not fun.
Thank you.
So the final topic of today goes to Marco. Make it quick. No, take your time.
Make it quick.
Yeah, it's a topic that is very very lighthearted, easy to discuss. So yeah, I'll try to make it quick in a way. Yeah, I think it nicely fits into the topics we discussed before. Because the other day we had a rather famous scholar originally from the US, now based in Australia here, and we had a chat, and then PhD student asked them her for advice, and she was like, the best advice I can give you is that people should always do a postdoc, always, to kind of relax from the stress you encounter as a PhD student. To also kind of reorient yourself, because as a PhD student, you are very much tied to your chair, your department, or whatever, to find out what you are passionate about. And then also to build a portfolio and to kind of release the pressure from the 10-year clock by establishing a proper pipeline. And while she said that, I almost suffered a heart attack because I did not go for this postdoc position. So I was wondering, now having both of you here, both Alex and you, Philip, who kind of skipped the postdoc, and Alex, who's about to finish his postdoc, do people need to do a postdoc?
I'll let Philip go first.
Yeah. So I think that there are a few elements that need to be considered, especially if we look at it from the US perspective. And this is that I did an extremely long PhD of 6 years with teaching included. So for in many, let's say, US scholar careers, this would have been longer than a 3-year PhD and a 2-year postdoc. And the second thing is what we discussed last time, like doing a postdoc means moving. I have a girlfriend who moved with me, and I could only get her buy-in by being able to tell her that we will stay there for longer than 2 years. And that was then a little bit the question, can I find an assistant professorship that allows me to do so? So that's why I was pushed there. When I would have been single, I think I would have gone for a postdoc. Yeah. Because especially at a top institution, again, to get the opportunity to do everything that you just said, because I think there's a lot of value to it. But I think we also need to consider where we are. And I'm also very happy that I left the PhD role, right? I was kind of done to be a student. And I'm very happy that I'm now an assistant professor and can do my work in a way that I think is the right way to do it for me. So yeah, that would be my answer. Generally, I agree, but there are contingency factors that made it my situation different. Alex, was it the right thing to do
this? I unlike Philip, I did it right, and I got divorced in time for my postdoc, so I didn't have to deal with that issue. And other than that,
what was first? I have a causality question.
That's it. That'll be for the next podcast. I needed the postdoc for sure, and I would have even liked to do it a little bit longer. And I think anybody that does a postdoc will feel like it was too short. I doubt there's anybody that had a postdoc that felt like I've had enough time now. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't regret it at all. It was tough. It was stressful. It wasn't at all relaxing. But it was. Yeah, I mean, sure, it was the nice thing really was this feeling of, all of a sudden, like, I can pursue, projects that are not determined by my PhD. But that was also the scary thing. It was like, oh, shit, I need to be like, I need to actually do stuff now. I can't just, I can't just lean back. I can't trust. I don't know. I can't always run to my doctoral supervisor and say, like, is this good? Is this good? Is this good enough? Is this going to get me a PhD? Because at that point, like, you're just like, hey, you need to, you need to establish your network. You need to pitch projects. You need to get on projects. So it's also scary. But yeah, I don't know. I wonder for how many PhDs is even actually still a realistic option to not do a postdoc before getting an assistant professor position. It's getting pretty hard. Like, even for me coming out of a postdoc, it was extremely difficult to find a position because it's people, you're competing not with PhDs, but you're competing with postdocs, you're competing with assistant professors that are changing, laterally. Yeah, I mean, if you want more options and if you want a little bit more time to just find yourself, then a postdoc is really, really something good. If it's really a postdoc, because there's like sham postdocs out there as well, right? I feel like we know institutions and countries where, mm-hmm. where, it says postdoc on the package, but it really just means, hey, we need more help in administrative grant writing and teaching. And we'll pay you about, €5 more per month than you'd got as a PhD. But really, you're in the same situation as before. So, yeah.
Marco, are you going back?
Are you going to do a postdoc, Marco?
To a postdoc.
Yeah, I hope not, no. but, I mean, like, also reiterating our last conversation, I felt like... obviously have to fill in fairly big shoes in a rather short amount of time. So, like, for me, I basically moved to Amsterdam and I was having a lecture on Thursday evening, and on Monday I was here as an assistant professor, and not much changed other than me now living in a small shitty apartment. So it was kind of a transition where I felt like this kind of period in between would have been helpful. So the Australian scholar said really resonated with me. However, obviously, for social reasons, I would not suggest it in a way, because like moving for 2 years, and I hate moving, to be honest, seems
me too.
Super stressful for me. And while I was in a favorable position of not being attached to any place, at least, sort of emotionally, but not to a partner, it would have been an option. And I was almost about to pursue an option like that. But still, I'm fairly happy that now I have some, at least a fairly long planning horizon. Not moving back, but... while I never saw the merits of doing a postdoc, now I feel like I do.
I think also the thing I wanted to also echo is like what Philip, I mean, it's really a pain. It's not just like, oh, I'll just do a postdoc. Like it was such a tough, like really, cause I also hate moving. And I don't know, but I feel like it's just a different thing moving in Europe than in the US. Like people just, you know, get in a car, put all their shit in, and it's like they, you know, they drive for 25 hours and they basically just change their neighborhood. But in Europe, you know, you fall over twice and everybody's speaking a different language. And so it's like, I don't know, it just makes everything a bit more complex.
You even left the union, right?
Yes.
Wow!
The rogue state of Switzerland, and so that is really like, you know, it's not an easy, because you're also moving with the clear knowledge that you will have to move soon again, which was at least for me very stressful. It was like I'm going into transitionary thing, and I basically have to think about where to go next before I even arrive. And the second thing is I feel like if one does a postdoc at the same time, and I don't know if you have different opinions here, is do not get like tempted to get hooked into a postdoc where you are already. I feel like that's not the point of a postdoc. It's like if your PhD supervisor or someone says like, hey, you know, why don't you just do a postdoc here?
I think that highly depends on where you are. And how your portfolio looks like.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, this is just, you know, this might be colored by where I came from or what I heard, but I don't know. I feel like to fully utilize a PhD, postdoc, like, I don't know, like a different setting, a different network, different environment is conducive rather than just rolling over into, you know, basically the same thing.
Last week I was back at my old institution, I felt like a PhD student again. And to be honest, I was treated like a PhD student again. So I feel like in this regard, it also helps
But you don't have to move, right? You guys complain for 20 minutes about moving and being offered a postdoc allows you to stay 2 more years without moving.
Yeah, I know, but it's like, I don't know. I feel like it's a false kind of security. I don't know. Like if it just feels like you're prolonging your PhD at that point.
And this is especially what I really did not want to.
Yeah.
I wanted to move to the next kind of role.
Yeah. But yeah, so all in all, I did the right thing. You all did the wrong thing.
you win, we lose.
Yes. As usual, I won. I won the episode again. I don't want to take control. But does this bring us to the end of our second episode?
I would say so. Yeah. Thank you guys. Nice therapy session.
As per usual, a lot of deep insights. For our ad segment, today's episode is brought to you by dropshipping companies pretending to be designer brands on Instagram. What's up with that? So that's all I got.
Isn't it, guys?
That's, I don't know what's up with
what
that.
Is, like, what is dropshipping?
That's the moment where I felt old, actually, because students explained it to me. Because one student of mine wanted to write a bachelor thesis on dropshipping, I was like, what the hell?
What is, guys? Sorry, I don't.
It's a TikTok dance.
It's like you're a bogus company, basically. Your only value added is to buy things and ship it to someone else. So you buy off, I don't know, these pink fans you see now emerging that you can carry around with you, or like all the ridiculous stuff that people sell to you at markets and stuff. But this is kind of scaled up. So, like, I don't know.
It's vibe entrepreneurship, you know, vibe coding. That's just it. It's like, you know, hey, how about I have no value for society?
I'm still waiting for vibe research. That's my jam.
It's going to be my title of my biography.
Okay, guys.
So I don't get it.
I go to Tenmu and see what I can sell.
and I'll read off the credits. Thank you very much for listening. Currently, you cannot follow us on most socials. And this is probably not going to change anytime soon, because we all have decided to take time off, and this doesn't count as taking time off. If you do like our podcast, though, you can go hit subscribe on Spotify, Overcast, Pocket Cast, Apple Podcast, or whatever player you use. And subscribe, friends and family, just steal their phones, just off strangers, and search for our podcast, and then, you know, subscribe them. They'll love it. Intro, outro, and ad music is by Blowdot Sessions, and this episode was probably produced by me, Alexander. Until next time, bye-bye.
Dewey. That's Dutch.
Das ist einfach nur die Uhr, oh, so eine schöne Uhr.
Ja, sorry, ich war gerade mit der Hand woanders und dann dachte ich, wie soll ich jetzt klatschen, wenn jetzt da der Recording-Hand noch
beim... Boah, ich war gerade mit der Hand woanders, das kommt 100 pro zum Schluss der Folge.
Soll ich die Tonspur eigentlich verwerfen, oder?
Nee, kannst du nicht.
Nee, die brauchen wir.
Die brauchen wir noch. Free audio post-production by Alphonic.com.